time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all so much for tuning in. And thank you for your patience while we took a much needed break. We loved reading all of your kind messages and comments, and it definitely provided encouragement to return. And to give just a little background on that, we have been busy, to say the least. And I got to the point where I felt like I was spending all of my limited free time immersed in researching tragedies, and it starts to weigh on you.
Yeah. And over the past few months, we've both been like extremely busy with our day jobs. I just got back home from basically a 2 month long trip away from home for work. And we've not only been busy in our professional lives, but you know, we just bought a house in September and been a nonstop project, basically, you know, furnishing it and doing projects. And we've just been extremely busy, but we're glad to be back.
Yeah, it was a little hard to have a podcast when you were physically not here for a while. And I mean, you did come home for a couple days here and there, but of course, we were trying to get a lot done during those periods. So anyway, this is just for those of you who were curious kind of what was going on. I know there were some of you who asked, so we wanted to give a little bit of background there. And I was experiencing some writer's block or research block, I will say, but I have some newfound motivation and I hope it lasts. But for now, we are going to stick to the bi-weekly release schedule that just works better for us. And one more thing, some of you reached out and offered to help us with the podcast, which is so nice. There's just not a lot we can outsource at this point. We do have an audio editor slash producer already, and he's great. But the one area I could use help with would be the research, but that's what I enjoy the most about the podcast. So it doesn't make sense to try to get assistance with that piece. So we have limited options there. Regardless, we so appreciate everyone who reached out. All right, let's dive into this week's case. Cynthia Kirk, who many called Cindy, was 34 years old at the time of her murder in 1989. Cindy was raised in the unincorporated community of Sandy Ridge in North Carolina. She had a typical childhood and really spent a lot of time with her older sister. It was just the two of them, and they became best friends. When Cindy was in first grade, she met a fellow student named Bill. And I doubt that Cindy had any idea at that time that she would one day marry Bill. According to reporting from the Greensboro News and Record, Cindy and Bill were friends all throughout their youth and into high school. But once they were old enough to date, they didn't. But they did maintain their friendship. After Cindy and Bill graduated from high school, they went different directions. Cindy enrolled in North Carolina State University, where she studied textiles, while Bill enlisted in the Air Force. Cindy and Bill would see each other from time to time on the weekends around the county they were both from, but the relationship didn't truly begin to take shape until a few years later, after Cindy had earned her degree and Bill returned home in 1977, having finished his 4-year service in the Air Force. Soon after, Bill enrolled at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, or Virginia Tech, in Blacksburg, Virginia. And the two navigated a long-distance relationship. And that bond continued to deepen despite the miles between them. They became engaged during Bill's college years, and in 1981, just 1 week after he graduated with a degree in civil engineering, they were married in Sandy Ridge. Bill has characterized their relationship as two pieces making up one part and describes Cindy as a beautiful person inside and out. Others have described Cindy as a smart, hardworking, loving, easygoing person who was respected by many. In her spare time, she loved reading, especially mystery novels, and watching one of her favorite shows, Murder, She Wrote. Now, they did like to spend time with friends and family, but Bill has said that they were kind of homebodies. They really enjoyed spending time at home with each other and found that to be something they looked forward to. When Cindy and Bill married, Cindy had already established herself in Pittsboro, North Carolina, so Bill moved in with her until they decided to move to the larger town of Cary, North Carolina, where they purchased their first home. So Cindy spent her whole life in North Carolina, from what I could tell, but she definitely moved around to different parts of the state. And they moved for the final time in the early 1980s because, according to reporting from the Herald Sun, shortly after they bought their house in Cary, Cindy and Bill were both let go from their jobs and eventually found new opportunities in Durham, North Carolina, one of the largest cities in the state, where they moved in 1984.
So what jobs did they both get in Durham?
Cindy landed a job as a second shift supervisor at Liggett and Myers, which is a tobacco company. I'm not sure if she used her textiles degree directly, but that's what she was doing when they moved to Durham. And Bill got a job working for a structural engineering firm. Cindy and Bill bought a Cape Cod style home in Western Durham. Now, they were attracted to the neighborhood because it seemed like a quiet area, great for raising kids because they hoped to have children one day. And this was a low crime neighborhood. I looked around this area. I couldn't find imagery from the 80s, of course, when this took place. But from what I could find, it looked like such a charming neighborhood. I know there were a lot of families who lived there and probably still are. So I can see what drew them to that specific area. And they saw themselves staying in Durham for the rest of their lives.
Do you know what their neighborhood was like? Like, was it pretty close-knit? Did they get along with their neighbors and hang out with them? Or did they kind of just stay to themselves?
Kind of seemed like they kept to themselves. I didn't see many statements from neighbors in this case. That doesn't mean they didn't talk to their neighbors, but I've seen in other cases where neighbors do come out and they make statements and talk about the person, right? And I didn't see that in this case, so I'm not 100% sure. Where I did see some statements was from the church they went to. So Bill and Cindy belonged to a church, and there were people kind of who they seemed to be close with, and they were pretty involved, right? So I did see some statements related to that. Just a few years after the move, Cindy and Bill found out they were expecting a baby girl, and she was born in 1988. We will refer to her as her or their daughter for the remainder of this episode because she was so young when her mom was murdered, and we want to respect her privacy. Cindy has been described as an excellent mother who spent much of her time outside of work caring for her daughter. Cindy, working second shift when their daughter was born, worked out fairly well because they avoided needing full-time daycare, since Cindy could take care of their daughter while Bill went to work in the morning until the afternoon, when she would take her to a babysitter who watched her for just a few hours until Bill picked up the daughter after work around 5:30 p.m. And then he waited up until Cindy arrived home shortly after 11 p.m.
They're probably saving a bunch of money not having to go to a daycare, but seemed like they kind of sacrificed their sleep schedule. I can't imagine they were getting great sleep with this arrangement.
Yes, I thought about that too, especially Cindy, since she was getting home a little after 11. At that point, I was thinking, okay, Bill probably just went straight to sleep. And then Cindy, I don't know, people who work until 11, I don't think they just go home and go straight to bed. So she'd probably take some time to wind down for the night. And then she has to get up you know, around the same time as Bill the next day so that she can take care of their daughter, right, when he leaves. So yeah, I think probably it probably had pros and cons. I mean, a lot of parents probably with a young child don't get great sleep, but I think this arrangement worked well for them at the time. And they seemed to be in a routine. They had settled into a routine and it was well established by the time of Cindy's murder when their daughter was about a year and a half old. August 21st, 1989 began as an ordinary day. Bill left for work that morning, at which point Cindy probably did what she always did. Took care of and played with their daughter and did some chores around the house until her sister Beverly arrived at Cindy's house to share lunch with her. Now, Beverly only stayed for a short time because she knew Cindy needed to put her daughter down for a nap and get ready for work. So she left Cindy's home sometime between 12 and 1 p.m., not knowing that would be the last time she saw her sister alive. Cindy typically arrived at work around 2:30 p.m., so that meant she would drop her daughter off at the babysitter's home around 2:15. Cindy was historically prompt, so as the minutes ticked past 2:15 and Cindy hadn't shown up, the babysitter was beginning to feel worried. And when Cindy didn't pick up the phone at her home, that led the babysitter to contact Beverly to see if she had heard from Cindy. And of course, she had seen her that day, but it had been a couple of hours at that point. And Beverly's husband worked at the same company as Cindy, so she got in contact with him first to check if Cindy was at work. And when she learned, kind of as expected, that she wasn't, she headed over to Cindy's house to check on her as soon as she could that afternoon.
Did the babysitter ever try to contact Bill when he was at work?
Not that I could find. So I kind of wondered if she didn't know how to get in contact with him at work. This is all before cell phones. The connection between the babysitter and Beverly is never fully explained, but it seemed like the babysitter was familiar with both Cindy and Beverly. So it was just easier for her to call Beverly at home and she answered. When Beverly arrived at Cindy and Bill's home around 3 or 3:30 p.m., she immediately noticed that Cindy's car was still parked in the driveway where it had been hours earlier when she left. As she got closer, she saw blood on the driveway and could tell it was leading toward the house. She was scared to learn what was inside, so she found a neighbor who was checking his mail and asked him to check on the situation with her. Once they approached the kitchen side door of Cindy's home, which was where the blood was tracked to, they found Cindy, deceased, lying in her own blood just inside the door. Cindy's daughter was still inside the home and she was unharmed and asleep in her crib. They called the Durham police immediately and they began to piece together what most likely happened based on the scene as well as the autopsy results, which revealed that Cindy had been stabbed. She died from multiple sharp force injuries to her chest and back. One source indicated that she was stabbed 5 times, although I didn't see that anywhere else. So the exact number of injuries she sustained is not clear. Cindy also had a defensive wound near her right thumb, and the murder weapon has never been recovered. However, the police believe they knew what was used to kill her. At the scene, Cindy was dressed in her work attire. She still had her key ring hooked over her fingers. And inside her car, the police found her purse and a diaper bag on the front passenger seat. One source said her purse or pocketbook was on the floorboard of the passenger seat. So it could be that maybe one item was on the passenger seat and one was on the floorboard. And according to Bill, in an interview with the Herald Sun, she usually brought those items out before retrieving their daughter, just so her hands weren't so full. So it seemed that Cindy went outside to put those items in her car, and from there, she was attacked and a struggle ensued. And this was further evidenced by the fact that one of her earrings was found wedged in a crack on the driveway. I mean, this is horrific. This has to be one of the most unsettling murders we've talked about. It reminds me of our 16th episode Molly McCauley, who was stabbed to death while walking her dogs, or I'm sure some of you are familiar with the Liz Barraza murder. We haven't covered that, but there are some similarities to that case as well. But most of us have been in a similar situation or are in a similar situation routinely, walking out to your car to put something in it or just walking out to your car to get in it. Who's to say this person wouldn't have targeted Cindy if she had come outside with her daughter? No one thinks they're going to be stabbed to death in that situation, even if you live in an area that's not the safest, which she didn't. But even if she did, most people don't think of this as something that could happen to them. This should have just been a normal day for Cindy. All reporting indicated that there was no evidence the perpetrator made it inside Cindy's house. All signs pointed to Cindy being attacked in her driveway and the killer fleeing from there. And I should add that there were no signs of sexual assault or robbery. Cindy's purse inside her locked car was untouched. And even though there was cash visible in the house and Cindy was wearing some expensive jewelry, none of it was disturbed. So with what I've shared so far, what are kind of your initial thoughts about this?
Yeah, with what you've presented so far, it does seem like it was just a random attack, which is horrifying. It just kind of seemed like a prime of opportunity.
But I think the thing about that is the window of opportunity was so short, right? Like
So you think this was potentially premeditated then?
Potentially. I mean, there are, and this is something we'll get into, but there are differing opinions even within the police department about whether this was targeted or random. I just think that window in which she's outside is so short, but she does it almost every day, right? So someone could pick up on her patterns if they didn't know her. And the only thing I'll add about the motive here, we cannot 100% say that the person did not go in with the intention of robbery, for example, and wanted to threaten Cindy and then panicked. And it just went completely awry. So if you think about that possibility, yes, they're saying nothing was stolen from her. She was not sexually assaulted. And that's all important information. But if we are thinking about this in the context of this being someone unknown to Cindy, it is possible that maybe they had the intention to either sexually assault her or rob her. And then it wasn't going as they planned and they ended up stabbing her. The Durham police went door to door in Cindy's neighborhood and found several witnesses who shared valuable information. And this information further informed their theory about what had transpired. Witnesses, made up of a landscaper, construction crew, and neighbors, reported that they saw a man driving an older model, olive green, four-door, American-made car, possibly a Chrysler, with a CV antenna on the back. They witnessed him park across the street from Cindy's house. The man didn't stay inside his car for long before he got out and walked up Cindy's driveway as she put those items in the passenger seat and shut the door of her car. These witnesses even saw Cindy briefly speaking to the man. They did not recall any hostility between this man and Cindy. He certainly didn't run up and immediately begin attacking her. But that was the extent of what they saw. They did not see Cindy's murder take place. And that's a frustrating part of this case. They were just seconds away from witnessing Cindy's murder. And not that you want someone to see that, but they would have been potentially able to intervene. And would that have guaranteed a different outcome in this case? We don't know, but it makes you wonder. One neighbor recalled hearing long, piercing screams around the time of Cindy's murder, but unable to tell where they originated, they dismissed the sounds, just assuming it was a child. The man was seen driving away in a calm manner. Cindy and Bill's neighborhood was just down the road from the highway. Their house specifically was about a mile away, so he could have gotten out of their neighborhood and onto the highway and out of that area very quickly. The police believed the entire ordeal unfolded in about 2 minutes, and that the killer may have approached Cindy pretending to need directions to a specific address or claiming to be in the area selling something.
It does make sense that he came up to her pretty nonchalantly. You know, you can't really just run up and start attacking someone. You know, you have to, I guess in this case, he wanted to disarm Cindy a little bit and make her put her guard down a little bit.
Yes. With the type of weapon that he had, we don't know for sure what it was, but I think a knife would make a lot of sense. I think with that kind of weapon, you have to get close to the person. If his intent was to attack her, yeah, he can't just run up and start doing that. I mean, he could, but it made sense to me as well that he could have come up and said something about selling something or needing directions somewhere and maybe even came across as friendly to get Cindy to engage with him right away. The police speculated that this could have been an attempted abduction that led to murder, but never established a clear motive. And as far as they've said publicly, they still don't have a clear motive. Of course, the possibility that this was a random murder instilled fear in the community. This was upsetting to people, and they looked to law enforcement to quell their concerns that they could be in danger, which they did not do immediately. But a few weeks into the investigation, they shared that the theory that a random person killed Cindy was not one they were focused on, considering they couldn't link Cindy's murder to any other similar cases. There was no pattern that they could find among other murders they looked into. And then they worked with other agencies as well to try to make connections, and they were never able to make a connection to another murder that they thought could truly be linked to Cindy's. The witnesses got a decent enough look at the unknown man. He was described as a clean-cut white man in his late 30s or early 40s, medium height and weight, with dark medium-length hair, dressed in trousers and a golf shirt.
So a standard run-of-the-mill white male.
It does sound very generic, but the witnesses who got the best look worked with a sketch artist, and that sketch was distributed to the public by late September, which was about 6 weeks after Cindy's murder.
Was anyone close to Cindy, like Bill or Beverly or the babysitter, were they able to identify this guy?
I don't believe anyone close to Cindy thought he looked familiar. Now, I will say Cindy's family did not speak about her murder for many, many years. They did later, which we'll discuss. So I'm making the assumption that at the time when they saw this sketch, it didn't ring any bells, and that could be wrong. Bill, on the other hand, did speak out and did not indicate that the sketch looked similar to anyone they knew. He talked about how devastating the loss was, but said he felt he was coping a little bit better than Cindy's family because he had their daughter to focus on. She needed him. So it seemed that people in Cindy's life didn't recognize the sketch. However, the police received hundreds of leads related to who that man might have been, and they also received tips about the car. The investigators tracked down every tip they could, to no avail, until 1990, the year after Cindy's murder. That year, the investigators staged a televised reenactment of Cindy's murder in hopes of generating new leads. Not long after it aired, a woman from Burlington, North Carolina, which is roughly a 30-minute drive from Durham, contacted authorities with a troubling experience she had on August 3rd, 1989, just 18 days before Cindy was killed. She explained that she came forward after seeing the sketch connected to the reenactment in a Greensboro newspaper. On that August afternoon, August 3rd, around 1:30 p.m., a white man pulled into her driveway and knocked on her door, claiming he had run out of gas and needed money because he'd lost his wallet. His behavior immediately struck her as suspicious. He had parked unusually close to the house in her driveway, which it's like, how did you run out of gas in the driveway? And there was a gas station not far away at all. So she doubted his story. But needing to leave for an appointment, she quickly handed him a small amount of cash. Her description of the man and his vehicle closely matched the witness accounts from Cindy's case. She estimated he was between 38 and 40 years old. Sources vary on the height, anywhere from 5'6 to 5'10. He was clean cut and dressed in khakis and a knit golf shirt. But possibly more importantly, he was driving an olive green four-door Chrysler with a CB antenna mounted on the back. She even managed to catch part of his license plate number, which was 6466. The man made no attempt to harm her, and she believed he might have assumed someone else was home, even though no one was, because another car was parked in the driveway. After taking the money, he quickly got back into his car and drove away. So there were enough similarities with this incident, and the timing was so close that it piqued investigators' interest, but they were never able to track down who that man was, even with the partial license plate. I have mixed thoughts on this. You know, thinking about her comment about how maybe he didn't do anything because he thought someone else was home, but if he were out to harm someone in the first place, why pick a house with multiple cars in the driveway? Regardless, what seemed like a promising lead never went anywhere. So you're left wondering if this was Cindy's killer or if this was just some random person who ran out of gas.
So we're working with two main details here. The description of the man, which is extremely generic, and then the vehicle, which in my opinion is a pretty unique car. I don't know how many olive green sedans you saw driving around back in the 80s, but I mean, today you don't really see any of those. So I would think that they could have taken that part of it and ran with it and tried to find, you know, people driving a similar car and see if the physical description of the person driving the car matched the sketch.
Yeah, I think they found vehicles that matched the description of the one she described and the one seen near Cindy's home when she was murdered. They just never put that with a person or linked that to a person who could be of interest, as far as we know. I mean, maybe they just held that closely and didn't share that. But yeah, the car to me stuck out a little more than the description of the man. She did say she recognized the sketch, but when you couple that with the details of the car that aren't so generic, I found that to be very interesting. So it's hard to just write it off.
It was a very specific color. It wasn't just green. It was olive green.
Yeah, olive green is a very specific color. Many years passed with little reporting on Cindy's case. It seemed the investigation was at a standstill. But in 2000, 11 years after Cindy's homicide, a journalist for the Herald Sun, Tom Gasparoli, hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly, he revitalized the case. He interviewed family members and investigators and published articles about it. It was Tom who got Cindy's family to speak about her case because, as I brought up before, other than Bill, they hadn't spoken publicly about it. When Cindy's parents were interviewed, they did so anonymously. They did not want their names to be revealed because they had a close relationship with their granddaughter, Cindy and Bill's daughter, and they indicated she might not know Cindy by name or image or really what happened to her mom, which I thought was so odd. When they interviewed the parents, she was maybe 13, and I can understand her not knowing exactly what happened to her mom. She was so young when it took place, but to potentially not know her name or face when she has a relationship with her mom's parents was very confusing to me.
Yeah, it's pretty bizarre. I mean, I guess the only thing I can think of that would be a reason for this is having pictures of her around or, you know, mentioning her name may just bring up that traumatic experience again. I don't know, but it's still weird not to know your mom's name or know what she looks like.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to cast judgment by any means. This was truly just perplexing to me, but I understand why then Cindy's parents decided to kind of participate in the interview anonymously. Cindy's parents were forever changed by the loss of their daughter, but they tried to focus on the 34 years they shared with Cindy. Her dad told Tom, the journalist, that detectives repeatedly questioned him about a particular person they believed could have been involved. He insisted, however, that he didn't think this person could have harmed Cindy. Despite his doubts, investigators remained suspicious of this person. And according to Tom, some sources even suggested that Cindy's murder may have been a hired killing.
I feel like if you hire someone to, you know, for a hit, stabbing typically wouldn't be the way to do it. I mean, I feel like stabbing someone is typically more like a very personal crime, right? Like if you hire someone for a hit, they're probably going to use a more, and I hate to say it, a more efficient way to do it.
If you had told me that someone walked up in Cindy's driveway with a mask over their face and with a gun and fired it at her, that would feel more like it could be a hired killing. I think that's what makes kind of what you're talking about is kind of what makes this hard to understand. The only reason I can imagine a hired killer would stab someone to death would be because I think it would draw less attention than a firearm, or they couldn't figure out how to access another weapon. But stabbing someone to death takes longer. And he was just out in the open, not covered at all, doing this in her driveway. And I understand why he wouldn't wear a mask, right? Because he needs to be non-threatening when he's walking up to her. First thing she's going to do if she sees a guy with a mask is probably run. It just seems you'd have a greater risk of being caught in the midst of the murder if it's a stabbing than other methods.
Also, I get that she was alone in this window of opportunity, but you know, it is interesting if it was a hit, like a hired hit, that they did this in broad daylight. I'm sure if whoever hired this person, if that was what happened, they would know Cindy's work schedule, know that she got off very late, and that there would probably be a better window of opportunity with less of a risk to get caught.
That's a good point. Yeah. But I also think if someone did hire someone to do this, maybe they picked a time where they knew they had a rock solid alibi and that they could be accounted for by multiple people. Whereas maybe most people at 11 p.m. when she got off work wouldn't have potentially as many people around to witness what they're doing to corroborate their alibi.
Yeah, that's fair.
But we're also not even engaging with like, why would someone hire a person to kill Cindy, right? We can talk about that more in a little bit because Beverly and her husband, I was just about to get into, have made some interesting statements, but it's still not a lot of information. But in 2000, Cindy's sister, Beverly, also began speaking with Tom. She shared that Cindy's death left an immense void in her life, one she still struggled to accept. Beverly and her husband, Gary, said they believe Cindy's killer continued to live in the area, and they understood the investigators felt the same way. According to them, detectives were convinced the murder was personal rather than a random crime. Although, I alluded to this before, some sources suggested that the detectives within the Durham Police Department had differing opinions on this. They also indicated that police had expressed doubts about one key person's alibi, suggesting it wasn't as solid as previously claimed. When discussing motive, Beverly and Gary believed that one of the classic drivers, money, love, power, or revenge, had to be involved. Beverly put it this way, quote, "Some behaviors don't make sense if people were innocent as they say. I'm very aware of situations that don't fit the way most people would live," end quote. They also told Tom that a detective received multiple calls about a particular woman, implying there was more to her story and that it cast her in a darker light. Beverly and Gary explained that they had three specific people in mind who could have been responsible for Cindy's murder. They openly shared these theories with investigators, but as they described it, those leads have gone nowhere. I was astounded by this. Three people they think could have been behind Cindy's murder, or is it one person they think who orchestrated it and three people who could have carried it out. I'm not sure, but this felt groundbreaking to me because Cindy seemed like she had no enemies. She was well-liked. So this was shocking to hear. There's clearly a lot we don't know about Cindy's life, possibly even Cindy's marriage to Bill, because we only really have his perspective on that. And if you read between the lines, I suspect people are suspicious of Bill. Yet no one has publicly declared that. Now, Bill was confirmed to have been at work when this happened and was not affiliated with a car like the witnesses saw that we know of. So if he had a hand in this, it would have been through someone else.
It seems like we could be suspicious of Bill, but I guess there's just not enough there to really warrant that.
Not from what we know. There's just not enough substantiated information out there to really go down that path with anything concrete. The theory that this was a personal targeted attack is not far-fetched. It seemed that this person may have known Cindy's schedule and knew exactly when to show up. Otherwise, we're looking at a situation where a random predator had been prowling the area and learned her schedule, or he was just out that day and stopped as soon as he saw her and made the decision to kill her. Now, there has been mention of potential DNA evidence in this case, but I couldn't find any information on if it was tested, retested, or even the quality of this evidence until 2005, when the police indicated that they had sent evidence to a lab for analysis, and the detective stated that the results were not what he expected, but they did shut one avenue down. So I get the impression that they had someone in mind, and as far as who could have done this, and it ruled that person out. So I don't know what to make of this case. I'll be curious to know what you all think. Of course, Bill is of interest considering he was Cindy's husband, but we'd have to believe that he had a reason to want Cindy out of his life and knew someone who would and could do that for him. I would be curious to know about other aspects of Cindy's life. Was there anyone at work who could have had a motive or a previous partner? Who are these three people that Beverly and her husband have in mind? Just so many unanswered questions.
I know her daughter wasn't even able to form memories when her mom was killed, but I mean, makes you feel for her daughter just growing up without her mom, not even knowing who she was. It must have been difficult.
I know. I kept thinking about her as well. She was so young when her mom was taken away, and it's possible that someone else entered her life after that and was raising her as alongside Bill. So I just hope Cindy's family can see resolution one day, because there's just been such little reporting on this case over the years. Much of what I shared today came from back when the murder happened or just the year after, but Cindy's family still wants answers. And they did do an interview. I believe the latest one I saw was about 6 years ago. And you can still see the pain in their faces. And they clearly are still jarred by this day and haven't been the same since. If you have information about Cindy Kirk's murder, you are asked to call the Durham Police at 919-560-4118. You can also call Crime Stoppers at 919-683-1200, and you can stay anonymous when leaving a tip. Thank you all so much for tuning in today. We are so glad to be back, and we appreciate your patience through our break. That is all for now, but we will be back in 2 weeks with a new case. Bye.
Bye.